say, first of all, thank you to Ron and Smith for asking me to speak this afternoon. When they gave me the topic, survey of apologetics, I thought it was kind of interesting. And as I began to progress into it, I found it even more interesting that it was such a broad topic. We have 45 minutes this afternoon in which to survey about 2,000 years. Now, I don't know what that fraction turns out to be, but we've got a long ways to go and a short while to get there. And so this afternoon, I'd like to don my New York pace and very quickly give you a brief survey of apologetics. And I'd like to focus in on that keyword survey. That's all it will be. Hopefully, it will just whet your appetite. We're going to be sticking very close to the notes because we have a lot of material to cover. Apologetics from the Bible is a very, very important subject for the Christian, because upon that hinges the proof of the Christian faith. From the very dawn of creation, the human creature has felt the need to justify itself and its actions. Most actions, whether good or bad, usually bring about a defense immediately from the doer. Mankind, it seems, has an indelible sense of moral obligation and moves in the direction of defending his positions or his deeds, be they right or wrong. One of the classic accounts of such an attempt at justification is found in the first book of the Bible, in Genesis. There the story unfolds, the epic is told of how God created man in sinlessness, and how that man, in eating of the forbidden fruit and transgressing God's commands, was found in a state of nakedness and sin. As Genesis records the account, one is led to understand that man, realizing his transgression, hid from the presence of the Lord. And Adam's reply to God in chapter 3, verses 10 through 12, becomes the first recorded apologetic statement in defense of the sinfulness of the human race. In this classic passage, Adam excuses himself by offering the plea of fear and the technique of blame and indicts Eve. Well, although this is from the Old Testament, this account gives us a basic insight into the definition and application of apologetics. Apologetics, simply put, means a speech in defense. There needs to be some distinction primarily made, though, and first of all, made between apologetics and apologize. Sometimes today, when we consider the two terms, we view them as being synonymous. They're actually not. One could imagine that to apologize for something means to make retribution or say, I'm sorry. However, the word apologetics takes on a different connotation. The word apologetics means to make a defense. It has a much more positive meaning. It simply means to defend one's position, be that position right or wrong. It does not necessarily carry with it the definition or the connotation of guilt. The word from the Greek, apologiai, means a speech in defense and simply refers to an oral and literary genre known throughout the ancient Mediterranean world. J.B. Tyson, in his book on New Testament Christianity, sums it up as this. The literary form of apology had a time-honored history dating back to the apologies of Socrates by Plato. The customary approach was to take the charges, explore their meaning, and demonstrate their erroneous nature. Their style was characterized by clarity of exposition and interesting detail. Many were replete with quotations from poets and philosophers. They generally concentrated on one major point and gave slight attention to one or two minor matters. A concluding appeal summed up the argument. It takes a learned person to be an apologist. The writer must write in a clear, forceful, and appealing style and must be familiar with a wide range of literary allusions. He must be aware of the basic ideas and motivating forces of his opponents and must know what in his defendant will appeal to them. It was in such a vein that the Christian apologetics tradition had their roots. Christians facing a Greco-Roman culture, buttressed by polytheistic beliefs and practices, where monotheism was judged to be blasphemous and also incredible, found reason to be their only defense. As the pagans discovered Christians would not serve the gods legitimated by the Roman authority, they were held to be sadistic, atheistic, and seditious elements of the population. In addition, the lifestyle that the Christians lived brought them up on accusations of cannibalism and incest. This may seem ridiculous to us in our knowledge of Christianity, but such was the case in the first century. Religious apologists can then be defined, or religious apologetics, rather, can then be defined usefully in modern terms as the laying out of fundamentals of religious belief. It becomes a systematic discipline seeking a rational justification for the truth it claims. As we shall see, though, apologetics by a particular group is rarely taken seriously by those outside of that group. Apologetics, if looked at in a realistic manner, tends to be self-stimulating literature. W. Walker, in his book On the History of the Christian Church, says that there is no evidence that apologists influenced heathen opinion in general, or that their appeal was considered seriously by the rulers to whom they were aimed at. However disappointing this may seem, though, it does have some importance. Apologetics within a group helps to promote the clarification of ideas within that group and forges a strategy of orthodoxy towards non-believers. In a nutshell, apologetics may be summed up as this: what rational defense can be given for the Christian faith? It is a theoretical subject. It is not a subject that bases itself within actual context of, if I say this, then what is he going to say back to me, or vice versa. But why study apologetics? How is it that today in the 20th century in the church it is important? Well, to the historian and theologian, the preceding material of the theoretical importance of apologetics may be some information and may be interesting from a theoretical and antiquarian point of view. But what is it that people today as Christians can grab hold of in looking at apologetics? You know, sometimes we look at apologetics, and because it is so theoretical, we view it as something that is not practical for the average Christian. You know, we view it as something as being a part of the upper educational or upper academia strata. And you know, sometimes today as we look at academia, oftentimes theology does enshrine itself within its own ivory towers, and the branches of higher learning are indeed filled with academia nuts. And sometimes we just don't really get the glimpse of what apologetics can have to do with our everyday lives. Again, it is a theoretical discipline. We must realize that to begin with. Apologetics is not for the purpose, like I've already stated, of teaching you, if he says so-and-so, then you say such-and-such. That is not the purpose of apologetics. It is a theoretical field. It deals best in theory. However, it does have some very interesting applications to the armchair student. From its very inception, Christianity has been under fire. And as the Christian looks at those hardships and problems that Christianity has gone through, they can realize that there must be a defense of the faith. You know, Celsus, who lived in 178 CE, was an anti-Christian writer. And he summed up, basically, some of the sentiment that we still find in the day in which we live today. He said, "The Christians demand a faith not based on examination, and this can only be an irrational commitment. Further, they shun open debate with the learned. They operate as a secret society, and despising wisdom, seduce the ignorant and the credulous. The Bible is full of childish legends and falls far short of the finest achievements of classical history. It falsely teaches that God changes his mind, that he chooses favorites among the human race, and that he manages the whole of creation for the benefit of man alone." Although we do not believe such to be the case today, the same sentiment is still given by agnostics, atheists, and deists alike in our day and time. It is simply not enough for us to brush off the idea that the gospel may be foolishness, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians, the first chapter. Atheism today demands an account for our belief as it never did in the past. We are living in a post-Christian era when the thought forms of our society are fundamentally anti-Christian. And though we live in a nation that is calling itself a Christian nation, it is very clear that the thought of men's imagination is on evil continually. Well, most philosophers adhere to atheism, agnosticism, or deism. Most universities in this country and in Europe alike adhere to one of these theories or these ways of viewing the world. As Christians, we cannot simply stand by exhorting people to believe without dealing with the problem on a rational level. In understanding the problem, it should be noted that logic may not always convince people, but it is a starting point in our sophisticated society whereby people can look at the gospel and not dismiss it as a logical absurdity. From the above comments, from what I've already said, it may seem that we've fallen into a paradoxical spiral. How is it that education is so filled with agnosticism and atheism that we can use education, that we can go to education to prove the Bible? Because that's really what we're doing when we go to history and various other proofs. We're going to logic to prove the Bible. Well, I'd like to say just a couple comments on that, because for those of you who practice apologetics, this might be of interest. First of all, clarity must be made. The problem in the 20th century Christian, or that the 20th century Christian finds himself up against, rather, is not education in general. Education, it might rightfully be said, brings one closer to God, because I believe true education does that very thing. The difficulty arises when education purports various theories and philosophies that have no coherency with scientific truth. The Christian need not fear scientific fact, for in no wise detriments Christ's philosophy. What the Christian needs to do is perhaps to look at the system of other people, theists, deists, and atheists alike, and try to pick out in those systems the flaws, and then bring them into a better understanding of Christianity. The European philosopher Wolfhart Pannenberg says, "For much too long a time, faith has been misunderstood to be subjectivity's fortress into which Christianity could retreat from the attacks of scientific knowledge. Such a retreat into pious subjectivity can only lead to destroying any consciousness of the truth of the Christian faith." In other words, today maybe we as Christians should get our heads out of the sand and meet head-on some of the deists and atheists' philosophies that we sometimes encounter. I like what Peter said in 1 Peter the 3rd chapter, verse 15, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is within you with meekness and fear." Be ready is the watchword for the Christian today. We have a tremendous responsibility and obligation to defend the belief that we espouse by philosophical means available. One cannot hope to convince others of Christ if they do not begin at the hearer's level. One with faith will have little success in speaking of faith to those that have no faith. A common substratum must be found. If the Christian is to approach his philosophical system from any perspective other than blind faith, education will be the tool by which that is accomplished. Education must be that which we verify Christianity by. Pannenberg again says that if Christianity is to make any meaningful claim to truth, it must submit to the same procedures of testing and verification as are employed in the secular sciences. You know, this may kind of take us back as Christians today, in that we think that we can criticize or critique, and I use that word in a very special meaning, the Bible by man's methods. How is it that we can take the Word of God and critique it by man's methods? Well, I believe that when we look at history, when we look at the Bible and try to prove it by history and by man's logic, we're doing just that very thing. And I believe today that some of the problem lies within the Christian themselves. Today, we need to not be afraid of education. We should use it. God gave us our intellect. We should use it to put forth His cause in a much more clear manner. I think sometimes we have totally disregarded education and taken the Bible only on faith, and I think maybe it's time that apologists of the church get back to using or meeting the arguments of atheists with their own arguments. You know, sometimes today, in fear of the philosophical jungle, where the serpent still tempts man with the forbidden apples, in our own rebellion we have not tasted of the fruit of the garden at all. The educational garden has much in it that is good for food. To do a justified study or a job in apologetics will require much work. Biblical criticism, biblical scholarship, and perhaps at least a taste of Hebrew and Greek will definitely be needed. In fact, we're going to have to do some very deep research in order to use apologetics to our ability, for the best of our ability, today. Well, again, we need to be careful. Scholarship today, even though it may be called biblical scholarship, is a useful but also a potentially dangerous thing. You know, biblical scholarship today sometimes stems from that 19th century era of skepticism that we find originating basically in Germany. And today, many of the things that the scholars purport are good and must be used, but we need to be careful as well. I do not believe that it is a problem, though, with the field of history or the field of apologetics in general. I think the problem is with man in that field. I think any field has the impetus to make heresy come from his beliefs. However, we today must realize that God's Word is strong and that we can critique it and prove it by scientific methods. Very quickly now, I'd like to look at New Testament apologetics. Apologetics has been defined. We've seen the importance of it because atheism and agnosticism are sweeping with an evangelical fervor this country and Europe and other countries alike. But what about New Testament apologetics? What proofs, what logic, what reason were used by the New Testament writers themselves and those that immediately followed? To begin such a study, we must first of all go to the New Testament text to discover the situation of the writers in the first century CE. To the casual reader, the New Testament might not seem to be an apologetical statement. In fact, apologetics may seem to play very little role in the New Testament itself. However, on a deeper surface, you generally will find that such a genre is included within the text. Much of the text on the New Testament is indeed apologetical. Consider the implications of the first century CE. While Christ had indeed promised his kingdom, and while he had established such, according to Acts, the second chapter, there would still be doubts and derisions arise. Jesus, a Jew by nationality, would be forced on by his fellow countrymen to verify his claims, as would his followers in centuries and generations to come. And though Jesus' fellow countrymen failed on a whole to accept his claims, the miracles and prophecy he cited would have a divine impact on disciples of the first and following centuries. Within this initial thrust of Christianity came the technique of proving Christ by the fulfillment of the old law. This became the primary essence of the New Testament's apologetical statement. It might be noted, first of all, that before Jesus, or before being an apologetic statement, Christianity was primarily a message of Jesus as Messiah and Lord. And as this message was proclaimed, it gave rise to questions. Notice some questions in the New Testament. In Matthew, the 13th chapter, verse 55, "Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and his brethren, James, and Joses, and Simon, and Judas, and his sisters? Are they not with us? Whence then hath this man all these things?" And they were offended in him. As Jesus began to do his works and began to proclaim himself as the Son of God, they wanted proof. Such a question about his birth and about his lineage became primary for Jesus and the apostles to answer. Paul oftentimes referenced the Old Testament in proving from the old law that Jesus was who he said he was. You can see, for instance, in Romans and in Acts, Paul does this over and over again. Also, questions were raised as to how Jesus could have suffered such a cruel death and could have been betrayed by one of his own fellow followers. The prospective Jew demanded, Jewish believer rather, demanded an answer. With such being the situation, Jesus and his followers looked again to the old law, to the Old Testament, to prove their claims. Isaiah and texts such as this were instrumental in proving through prophecy that Jesus was who he said he was. In the earliest charismatic proclamation, the disciples of the church pointed to the old law and prophecy to prove what they asserted. It is important to remember that Christianity was viewed by many Jews as a deviant form of their national religion. Therefore, Jesus and the apostles had to give them some proof that fitted within the context of their background that they had been raised in. Again, they pointed to the Jewish law. They pointed to the Old Testament prophecies by Isaiah and other writers in the Old Testament. Even Christianity as it spread was initially taken to the Jews, and this had a great impact on the proof that apologists would use in the New Testament text itself. Even Paul, the great pagan evangelizer, took the gospel initially when it usually went into a city to the Jews. Much of the New Testament is called calls on the Jewish reader's knowledge of the old law to understand its illusions and its proofs. Hebrews, which has been called by Alexander B. Bruce the first Christian apology, and also 1 Corinthians, are excellent examples of such writings. To the early church, the Old Testament scriptures were vital in their understanding of Jesus as both Son of God and Messiah. And I believe that verses like Acts 17:11 are illuminated in such a context. These were more noble than those of Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the scriptures daily whether those things were so. Jewish Christians turned time and again to the tradition that they had been raised in to meet the arguments that were thrown up against them that Jesus could not be the Son of God. Parts of the New Testament and the major Pauline letters, reveal a preoccupation with apologetics and pointing to the old law. Well, although the Jews were the primary target of New Testament theology and apology, it is quite clear that initially the Jews got the gospel first, but it would eventually be taken to the Gentiles. This is especially significant following the Jewish rejection of this new religion, this Christianity that Christ had died for. Paul's statement in Acts the 13th chapter is an apt expression of the sentiment of the apostle. It says, "It was necessary that the word of God should first have been spoken to you, but seeing that ye put it from you and judge yourselves unworthy of everlasting life, lo, we turn to the Gentiles." With this decision, the waves of apologetical tide flow out in the direction of the Greek world and toward the succeeding generations. From this point, Christian apologetics would never be the same. Without this decision to expand the gospel and kerygma to the Gentile world, one study of this field might be very brief. However, it was in the fertile soil of Greek learning that apologetics, as we know them today, germinated. The culture of this new environment gave synthesis to the light of the gospel. This light synthesis, or photosynthesis, if you would have its roots in the Apostle Paul and would bloom for the next several centuries, producing some of the greatest theological minds of all time. It is looking at the Apostle Paul that we can see an expert in Jewish as well as Greek logic. That's where it seemed to start, with the Greek world. His encounters with the Greek and Roman world point out time and again his ability that he had in assessing human nature and human endeavors. You know, it's been said that Paul represents the ideal Pharisee and Greek philosopher. Paul uses all of his techniques to bring the gospel to all of the world. Acts is replete with examples of apostolic apologetic statements. You know, Paul's greatest defense probably is found in Acts the 17th chapter. Paul's Areopagite address there resounds with the techniques used by later apologists. F.F. Bruce says that in several respects, Paul's Areopagitica anticipates the Christian apologies of the second century. Well, just a final note before entering the unholy ground of the patristic era. And that is that the first century was a difficult time for the gospel to grow. It was a time when people had to undergo persecution and hardship and poverty. Paul himself, in 2 Corinthians 11th chapter, lists his perils and his trials that he had to go through. And time and again, Christianity was required on to meet their opponents head on and to then take the gospel to the Gentile world. We've seen so far that the gospel, first of all, was taken to the Jews. The Jews accepted that gospel or rejected it, but the apostles and Jesus tried to prove the gospel by the Old Testament law. Secondly, Paul, as the Jews rejected the gospel, took it to the Gentiles. And from this initial setting then, apologetics, as Paul initiated them, would go on to expand through the Gentile world. And in the Gentile world, as we know apologetics today, is where this all had its inception and beginning. The Christian age, as it came in, brought in a new form of a theology, if you will. And as the theology of the New Testament encountered the civilized Greek world, a turn of events came about to change the entire apologetical discourse up to this point. Apologetics would become something far different than they ever had before. No longer would Christianity appeal only to Jewish tradition and law to prove Christ's claim, but classical Greek logic would be employed. This is a first, for up to this point, Greek logic had not been used. A bright theological sunrise could be seen peeping over the cultural horizon. The era of learning, however, though brisk with excitement, was not without its storm clouds. While the succeeding generation would produce some of the most skilled minds in defending the truth, it would also, at the exact same time, produce some of the most divisive action against the church of the first century. With a complexity of logic came a complexity of theology. And the end result would be a new form of Christianity far different than that which Jesus and the apostles gave to the world. Division, in spite of the great minds of the day, would be inevitable. However, there are some very important things that we can learn from this unholy patristic era that brings us up to modern day apologetics. Apologists of that day began to use Greek theology. They began to use Greek analogies, rather. And they really brought the art of apologies, of apologetics, to its final conclusion. Apologists of the early part of the second century followed their forerunners. They built upon the logic that had been already given to them by not only Jewish scholars who had become Christians, but also Gentile Christians as well. And the methods of this 20th century apologetics would gradually arise from this stratum. I believe today, as we look at the apologists of the patristic era, that there were four reasons that they wrote. In other words, there's four groups of works that we might want to look at. The apologists wrote, first of all, for converts who wanted to justify the radical change of life from paganism. Secondly, they wrote because philosophers were attacking Christianity and were becoming sophisticated, causing Christians to feel the need to give a more reasoned response. Thirdly, they addressed emperors who were trying to make Christianity more viable for the country and getting a response from the emperors that would be positive. And then lastly, Jews who were trying to slander Christians were addressed because Jews were trying to tear down this new religion that had been brought into effect by Jesus Christ. Well, the apologists themselves can be classified into two forms as well: political apologists and religious apologists. Political apologists strove to address the issues of Christianity and tried to win favor from the state. They tried to win from the rulers a favorable condition in which Christianity could grow. You remember in the early part of Christian literature and Christian tradition, Christians were persecuted, they were killed for their faith. And these apologists of this early time tried to gain political refuge for the believers of that day. Secondly, there were also the religious apologists. These apologists faced their own opponents head on. They strove to try to show from the ridiculous system of pagan philosophy that Christianity was really the only way to go. Well, some of these apologists you might want to look at on your own time. First of all, Aristides. Secondly, Justin Martyr. Thirdly, Athenagoras. Fourthly, Clement of Alexander. Origen also is very important. Tertullian, again, is tremendously important. And I'm having to go through about 20 pages here of notes because we're running out of time, and I want to get to a couple more things. But there is tremendous logic being employed by all of these apologists. Also, if you really want to get into some of the meat of apologetics, you might want to look at Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. Their views are tremendous in proving that the Christian religion was a viable way of worship to God, as opposed to those pagans then who they were fighting against. Well, what about practical apologetics? How is it today that we can gain some kind of interesting and useful use of what we've noted. Well, practical apologetics proves the existence of Christian faith. I believe today we need to look at just two things very briefly, and that is the existence of God, and secondly, the proof of the resurrection. And I'll deal with the existence of God. If we get to the proof of the resurrection, fine. If not, you can ask me about it in the question session. But first of all, without the proof of God, then everything else becomes meaningless. It has no reason, we have no reason, rather, if God does not exist, to be here to try to do anything religiously, because we're on our own, basically, in this universe. If God does not exist, first of all, life is meaningless. It is fruitless to try to do anything that is good if God does not exist. Life without God is absurd. You know, I think today, as we look at the absurdity of life without God, we might also view this as cultural apologetics, because it simply tries to show from a negative standpoint that if God does not exist, then we have no business or no reason for going on with our lives in general. Well, how does this refer or relate to the proving of God? How do apologetics and the predicament that mankind is in relate to God? Once mankind has denied the existence of God, then human life becomes worthless. If God is not existent, then there remains no need for morals, rules, or kindness to one's fellow man. If there is no supreme good, then there's no good at all. And if God does not exist, then there is no definition of evil. And today, it matters not how we have lived. You know, since the Enlightenment, when man threw off the shackles of religion, he's tried to answer the question of who am I and why am I here and where am I going without reference to God. The answer comes back that we are, without God, an accidental product of nature, a result of chance, and have no value whatsoever. Our lives are absurd. We are but a spark in the blackness of the expanse of the universe. We are a spark that flickers for a little while and then dies forever, never to be reunited with God or with the final flame again. You know, Jean-Paul Sartre observed, the French existentialist observed, that once we have lost eternity, several hours or several years make no difference. In other words, if we have to give up the existence of God and the belief in God, then our lives have no further purpose. Our death is of no consequence, neither is our life. We are no better than a swarm of gnats that plague the barnyard of life. We are belched up from the blackness of the universe onto the face of the earth to again be swallowed into utter darkness. If God does not exist, then we are worthless. We are a lump of slime in the universe that evolved rationally. We are the cosmic orphan. We have no purpose in being here. But I'd like to prove to you that God exists, or show you a couple of the proofs that have been purported to show that God exists very quickly. First of all, the ontological argument. This was started back in the medieval times by Anselm of Canterbury, and it states or tries to prove the existence of God from the very concept of God himself. It becomes very difficult, but I'd like to try to go through this very quickly. God is the greatest thing that we can conceive of. Because if there was something greater than we could conceive of, then that thing would be God. Well, since God is the greatest conceivable thing, then God must exist in reality. Well, how do we know that? Well, Anselm, who originated this theory, said it was kind of like a picture. If I began to imagine in my mind a picture, that picture might be great. But it's never the greatest until I actually paint that picture. Now today, if we imagine God in our minds, and if God is only a figment of our imagination, then God, that makes no sense, because it wouldn't be God. For God to be God, and to be the greatest, he has to exist in reality. Perhaps the following breakdown will explain more clearly. God is the greatest conceivable thing. Existence in reality is greater than existence in thought. Therefore, God must, by definition, exist in reality. Secondly, the cosmological argument has also been put forth as to prove that God exists. And this is trying to establish that God exists by looking at anything and establishing that it must have had a first cause. And this originated even back in the time of Plato and Aristotle, and has been advanced by Anselm, Descartes, Aquinas, and other philosophers. Basically, the argument summed up says that everything that exists must have had a cause. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Nothing is put in motion without something or somebody or something putting that in motion. The universe is in motion. Therefore, it must have had a beginning. You know, there's some scientists today who say, well, the universe did not have a beginning. It's infinite in both directions. Time flows out from this present moment infinitely in both directions. However, I think that as we look at that, that logic is really absurd. First of all, one cannot form an infinite collection of events or days by successive addition. If the universe did not begin at some point in time, we could never arrive at this present moment, because this present moment is really a compilation of days from the past. And therefore, if the universe never began to exist and always was, we could not arrive at this point in time where we are today. Thirdly, the teleological argument states that reasons from design, and that is that anything that has design or anything that has logic within it must have had an intelligent designer. William Paley was undoubtedly the high point in this argument when he uses the arguments of the watch. He says if you see a watch out there, it's got its intricate works, there had to be someone who made that watch. The same is true with the universe. Today, with the universe, since it is so intricate, and since it does such precise movements, it must have had an intelligent designer. You know, it might be noted at this point, very quickly in passing, that the atheists, I believe, really from a non-scientific perspective, that's my perspective, that atheists, while professing a disbelief in God, have really substituted various scientific theories in place of God. They really believe in a higher power. It may be their own self or their own theories, but they believe in something that they purport to be higher. And so really when the atheist is ridiculing the Christian, he's ridiculing himself, because the atheist has faith, whether he likes to admit it or not. He has faith in what he calls scientific theory or whatever. You know, the assertion by some that they do not believe because they are scientists is addressed by Hans Kung in his book, Does God Exist? A tremendous book if you really want to get a picture of apologetics. He says in writing his book that his writing is sustained by the hope that a new age is dawning when the very opposite answer will be given. That, of course I believe. I'm a scientist. You know, just now, scientists are beginning to discover what the Bible has stated for thousands of years. There must have been a beginning. The universe began to exist. It had a beginning. It had a first cause. This is proved by both scientific theory and the Bible itself. Perhaps the truth of the matter is that man, for so many centuries, while considering himself enlightened, tried to push God out of the picture. His supposed enlightenment in the end could not illuminate his works of darkness. The following quote, I'd like to sum up with this on the idea of God, I believe is a delightful summation of what we're trying to say. The quote is this: "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." Maybe it is that God's people and the theologians and that men of God have known what scientists are just now discovering. The universe began. It had a first cause. It is brought into existence by an intelligent being. How much time do I have to spend?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. In conclusion, I'd like to talk just for a second about the resurrection factor. And that is, without the resurrection, we really today are in a bad state. Even if we believed in God, without the resurrection, we have no hope of immortality. We have no hope of a better life. I believe the resurrection today can be proven by several facets. First of all, I think we can establish that the tomb was found empty. The common knowledge of the people of the day, if the tomb had not been empty, could have produced a corpse. Joseph of Arimathea, an honorable counselor, a rich man, was a tremendous witness that the Bible uses. And certainly, if the Bible were trying to purport a myth, they would not have used such a honorable man in their story. Secondly, women in the story of the New Testament are said to be the first witnesses of the empty tomb. And had the Bible been trying to purport a myth, from all historical indication that I could find, they wouldn't have used women as their witnesses. Now, I don't like this any better than you women do, but it seems that in the first century, the witness of women was not regarded as being very important. And so if the Bible were trying to purport a myth, it would not have used the witnesses that it did for the resurrection. There are several theories that have been purported as to why the tomb was found empty. The conspiracy theory, and that the disciples came and stole the body away, that was started in the first century in Matthew 28. That theory is preposterous because it makes the disciples out to be charlatans and frauds. And certainly, from an historical perspective, nothing can be said of the apostles that fits with that context at all. There's also the apparent death theory, the theory that says that Jesus only appeared to die. From all medical evidence, if you'd like to get into that deeper, it's virtually impossible. No way could a man back at that time, where there's no antibiotics and no form of modern medicine as we have to know it today, could have gone through what Jesus went through and still have survived the burial in the tomb for 3 days. Also, Paul, in the eyewitness accounts in 1 Corinthians 15 chapter, gives us a tremendous insight into the resurrection, because he invites the Corinthians to check out his sources. He gives about 513 or 14 individuals, at least, that saw the risen Lord. We have to account for what they saw. And he's almost saying, check it out if you want. It's very important. Finally, I'd like to say one word, just 1 minute, on the ultimate apologetic. You know, I believe today that we can look at apologetics from a theoretical standpoint till we die, and we may never get to the bottom or may never really understand what apologetics is all about. Apologetics is really designed to prove the Christian faith. And today our lives become the most important, the ultimate apologetic. Jesus said, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you. That by this," he says, "shall all men know that you are my disciples." Today we should not be so much interested in apologetics that we forget the sinner. Today we should not be so much interested in apologetics that we forget our purpose behind those apologetics. We should strive to know our subject profoundly and share it as simply as possible. Our lives are the greatest apologetic statement of all time. I feel like I've run roughshod over this material, but time's up.